Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Thank you. Mom, thanks again. This is my mom out there. That was the only person in the audience. Isn't she great? What enthusiasm. You know what? Enthusiasm is the God within you. I love her. Thanks, Mom. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which has shrunk a little bit. The GSO, and that's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the auspices of The Grapevine, which is our monthly meeting in print, has produced a book. And the book is called One-on-One Sponsorship. It's the first time this organization has produced such a work in the 78 years, almost 79 years, of its existence. Comprehensive sponsorship information has not been forthcoming, and the way sponsorship works and has been working in the past, the way your sponsor sponsored you, the way his sponsor sponsored him, the way his sponsor, you get to drift. So it was like telephone. Some things were added. Some things were lost. Some things were changed. So at least now there's some comprehensive information how that process worked. I always wondered, gee, that's kind of strange. It's the most important part of addiction recovery is the sponsorship interaction with the new sponsee or the new man. But we have no written material. We're using the verbal tradition to accomplish this essential goal. Now, some folks say, well, we have Chapter 7 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a great chapter, and it works really well. What I've discovered is the process has been dragged out. So if you're just using the Big Book and it's done quickly, all the information you need is in the Big Book. But if you drag it out, more information is required because more things will come up in time. So at Rum Radio, we put some of that information made available. You don't have to use any of it. You can use all of it or some of it. So you take what you see. There's a lot of good information. So take a look, and this way you can have contempt, but only after investigation. And remember, a mind is like a parachute. It works best when open. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. Thanks, guys. Every little bit helps. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. By the way, I hadn't printed anything in some time. Greg, the publisher, had been out of pocket, and I hadn't really sent anything, and I just sent some things in. I did a piece. It's called Children of a Lesser Charge, AA Batteries. It's kind of cute. And they're going to be printing that. They're glad. They said that they're looking forward to some more pieces from Rum Radio. So, RecoveryToday.net magazine. I gratefully like to acknowledge my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. So does the country. So does the world. Harold also goes to the prisons. What we found with the families is that most of the time the children aren't being taught correct principles. If you teach a child correct principles, they can teach themselves. But without these principles, they kind of grow up like empty lot weeds. The mean streets, drugs, alcohol, and rock and roll. That's how I grew up. A lot of folks, that's the story. Not necessarily. I've seen both ways. I've seen people coming from fine families, upper crust, money, education, and they were just alcoholic or drug addicts. Why? Put a plate under it, haven't got a clue. Goes both ways. And I've seen people come up from the most dire of circumstances and overcome it and become something of note. So we never know which way this thing is going to make a decision on that. Let's see what else. Harold, so say hello tonight.
Hello, everybody. Harold?
There you go.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, and I consider it a privilege. I've been working with some very troubled families, helping folks get organized and realize what's reasonable and what's unreasonable so they can set some healthy boundaries. And I had the honor of facilitating an intervention on Saturday night. And it was an 18-year-old boy doing his senior year over again, experimenting with drugs, drinking, and just being generally obnoxious. And so what we did was we had everyone write a 5-part letter that outlined how much the boy was loved, what they know about the problem, how scared they feel for his welfare, asking him to get help, and finally part number 5, put your mic on mute, Mr. Jancy. And part number five is what they're going to have to do to take care of themselves if the person won't go to treatment. And so it was successful. About 75% of the time, an intervention is not successful. But this one was, it was well prepared for. There were 8 people in the room, aunts, uncles, grandparents, parents, and they had found an empty bed at a treatment center so that he could go directly there. Very, very effective. And when the boy's 20 or 25, he'll thank his parents for doing that. Right now, he doesn't like it, but he will appreciate it later. So that's part of the work that we do. I often go into the jails to teach lessons about recovery and about family teamwork, how to get along better in the real world. So I appear here on the radio show as one of the ways that I give back. I also want to mention to our listeners that Joseph does the same. He's put together the website, rumradio.org, and the radio program, Rum Radio, as his way of giving back. He does not make any money from this adventure. In fact, it costs him, he's invested thousands in establishing the website and keeping it updated, in addition to his writing skills, which I think are terrific. So it's an honor for me to be here, and I appreciate him for investing his time and money in helping others the way he and I were helped when we needed help. There were people going to the meetings and working the steps and sponsoring people. If it weren't for them, we'd both be dead. So I appreciate being here and everyone that invested in their recovery so that I can have my recovery. It's all a gift from God. So thank you, Joseph. I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Harold. Oh, thank you for reminding me. I was sniffling, wasn't it? I'm coming down from a cold. Actually, I'm coming up from a cold. If you'd like to give out the number and the chat room.
Yes, absolutely. I have the chat room open. Let me go back here. I'm on my laptop. The call
I'll give the number.
If you'd like to call in, we're live on Sunday nights at 9 Central Time, and that's 949-534-0621, 949-534-0621. And the chat room is open. You find that by pressing the live button on rumradio.org. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. We like to start the show with a prayer before we introduce our interview for tonight, and you're going to like this. The reason we start with a prayer, most folks in the program, most meetings start with a prayer, they end with a prayer. It's called an invocation and a benediction, and it kind of invites in the spirit. So we try to stay online, and we believe that alcoholism and drug addiction is a spiritual disease. It's mind, body, and spirit. Dr. Jung, J-U-N-G, had said in a letter to Bill W. early on, before AA even really started, was that he believed that alcohol was a lower form of spirituality. And it was, in medieval language, it was man's quest for wholeness with God. So you could see how the spirituality, Harold likes to say, looking for God at the wrong address. So I'd like to start with the prayer, and the third step prayer is found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not AA, NA, or CA, Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. This is more like Paranoids Anonymous, where nobody tell you where they hold a meeting. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're not affiliated with any of the 12-step programs, although I like using basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous because all 12-step programs derive from the template found in the 12 steps in this book. So it's a good way to go back to a basic understanding of how it all works. I even found a scripture in the Bible, and most, or if not at least the majority of the folks that I find in AA are agnostic. Harold goes to celebrate. And in celebrate, what we usually find is that they have the love of Jesus. They go that way. So the agnostics and the atheists have taken over, for the most part, AA in that sense. My experience, maybe not all over the place, but that's in my experience. And so they're a little reluctant with the God deal. Jesus isn't in there. You know, very rare you'll see Jesus make a mention. And then God right now is even trying to be pushed out. It's not so much AA. I think it's just society as a whole trying to push him out. I don't know what that's going on, but that's what seems to be happening. So we start with the third step prayer. I give this to my sponsees as one of their first assignments when they turn from prospect to sponsee to get a home group, and in their home group get the name of men. The men with men and women with women we find to be the most productive because it's easier to relate to the same gender. 1, 2, sponsorship is a very intimate relationship that can be easily misconstrued and cause trouble. Romance changes everything. So the key, though, is that you work the steps. And if that's the way it works out, that you have a different gender and you're working the steps and it's working out, great. That's what we recommend. You work the steps. And one of the first assignments I give is to call one of these fellas every day for the first 30 days, which I think is kind of honed down now. People are starting to go through the steps, I think, a little faster. It's getting to be more of the general agreement now, get them through quicker. But I do the Joe and Charlie McHugh deal, 30 to 45 days, when possible. Some people are going through in 24 hours. I have it on the website, how to get someone through in 24 hours. Seems to be very productive. That's the way they did it. That's the way the pioneers did it. They had a phenomenal rate. Of course, they'll always be in an agreement. You get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. So for the next 30 days, I want you to call one of the fellows, and one, to get used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects them up with the fellowship. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. Three, the third step prayer, also called a surrender prayer, encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the person he's calling might have been considering of picking up his first drink, his first hit of crack, his first whatever. And chances are he will not, but there's no guarantees. But you have your sponsee in service already, and we found that to be the one immunity we have from alcoholism is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail, and this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness as those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen, brother. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you. Well, now I'm going to introduce you to our interview for tonight, Melanie Curtis. And Melanie has quite the story. She's had a severe tragedy in her life. It's probably the biggest tragedy a parent can have, the loss of a child. I have that personal experience, too, so I can relate to her on an empathetic level. Most folks cannot. They can be sympathetic, but empathy is a hard way to get. To be empathetic in a situation like that. So she's, with that energy, and which I found, that energy, she's turned it to do some good, to take the ultimate tragedy and turn it into an ultimate good by trying to save or trying to help someone else from experiencing what she had to experience. So she's done this with certain areas. What is it, Melanie, what do you call it? What is it, pharmacy fill?
Well, that's kind of the end result of what we've started. We're doing educational programs. And this is, and Pharmacist Phil is one that's developed for K through third graders. And so it's a mobile application. I worked with five IT students at Boise State University who developed a game, a mobile application that's accessible on your smartphone, your tablet, or your desktop, and it has four little games in it that kids learn about locking up medication. They learn that you take your medicine as the doctor tells you to, and you don't share it. Also, to dispose of it properly, and then only to use one pharmacy. But it's little video games, and then what happens is. The kids play the games. Then there's a pledge. It's a connected piece of pledge, which gives mom and dad action items they can do in their home to reduce access to prescription drugs. Because one of the things I found out when I started researching what had happened to my son is I found that 70% of the people that misuse prescription drugs are getting them from friends and relatives. They're coming into your home and getting them out of your medicine cabinet. So if we can, you know, lock them up, that can help stop the flow of drugs.
Great. Okay, well, that gives us a background, but let's do this, Melanie. Excuse me. Let's go back to what's your son's name?
Sure. Michael Patrick Campbell.
Okay. And now as a parent, when was the first time you had noticed that there was a problem with drugs, or had you ever noticed, or was it school? When did that happen?
He didn't have any trouble until he had graduated from high school. He was a soccer player, and he was continuing to play soccer after he'd gotten out of high school, and he went and played indoor soccer during the winter. He was a goalkeeper, went for a save, and ended up running, basically slammed his both arms or hands into the wall and broke both wrists. And so that's really his injury and the surgeries and stuff like that, where they prescribed the painkillers, were really instrumental in him becoming addicted.
You didn't know that he didn't have an addictive personality that you could tell at the time.
Well, you know what? His father was an addict, you know, poly drug user, so it wasn't a surprise that he would have the genetic makeup. But it was, you know, but he definitely developed it. And so that's kind of when it started, and then it just kept getting, worse and worse. Because he was very, very skilled at hiding it, and so I didn't know how bad it was until the very, very end. So
now, what kind of drugs was it? Painkillers, or was it speed, or was
it was benzodiazepines, so Xanax, and hydrocodone, which is an opiate. And I think his doctor, unfortunately, had prescribed a Xanax, and I think she left that prescription going for way too long. And, you know, I could tell when he was running out, because he was very irritated, so that made me aware of what was going on. But that was in the last few months of his life. And go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, I was just curious to see when you first noticed. Okay, so now he's going to the doctor, and then you're assuming that because he's going to the doctor, and the doctor's giving him a prescription, that the doctor. My parents were like that, but they were, you know, they were old Italian kind of folks, and if the doctor gave it to them, it was okay. My mother was prescription drug addict most of her life, but we didn't know such things. You know, that was like the doctor gave her like these little boxes, and they had black mollies, and now because I didn't know, I was a kid, I had no idea. But she'd be scrubbing the house, and she'd be and she was always full of energy, and and she loved them, and she even gave the drugs to my sister.
Uh-huh.
She got my sister hooked on it, but she didn't, because she was getting it from the doctor. Even she passed now, but it's okay, and the doctors were making money on the, weight loss. She's keeping her weight down, and she's got all this energy, and then she pops them at night to go to sleep and pops them up in the morning, and they're all coming from the doctor, and, you're not feeling good here. Take some of these pills. You'll feel better, that kind of deal.
Well, and I think that's a big part, the big difficulty with prescription drugs, is that we are lulled into trusting the doctors and thinking they know best. And I think we really need to empower ourselves and ask questions about it. I know, like right after Michael died, I went to the doctor because I wasn't sleeping and all that stuff. And she wanted to put me on Xanax, and I told her, no, my son just died from this. I'm not taking it. Then she goes, well, how about Ambien? And I go, no, that's also, it's also something that you can get addicted to. And then she goes, well, you could try melatonin. And I go, okay, so I did try that, and that helped. And I said, why didn't you start with melatonin? So anyway, just some of my frustration with, the medical community. I think that, it's so easy just to write a script, and whether that's what you need or not.
Harold, how about you?
Hello?
Have you had experience? You're in the professional field like that. Have you had that experience with the doctors of giving inappropriate prescriptions, and they keep just renewing it?
Yes.
Yes, I've had many clients who were taking their medications according to doctor's orders.
Yes.
And they stayed on there way too long. They were addicted, even though, because of tolerance. Tolerance develops over time, and the same amount of medication achieves less effect over time.
Right.
That's tolerance. And so these patients that I worked at Riverside General Hospital, and the people were following doctor's orders, and they were badly addicted. They were chemically dependent on their medication, even though they were following doctor's orders.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what I found over time is that many of these doctors actually receive a kickback from writing prescriptions for certain pharmaceutical companies. And so they have a vested interest in their hidden agenda. And
yeah.
It's very, very sad. And many people lose their lives in situations
mm-hmm.
like that. My heart goes out.
Yeah. Well, the agency that I run, one of the things we do, safe and sober housing and other recovery support services. And I actually have two programs that serve veterans, and that's a group that we see being prescribed, you know, just tons and tons and tons of prescriptions. And
yes.
Oftentimes it's painkillers, and it isn't, you know, it really, you know, and that thing, that has been really sad to watch that.
What is it? They're trying to keep them on ice?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know if, I'm not sure why. I know that they have done some interventions. We had one gentleman recently who was on Dilaudid, which is, you know, heavy, heavy duty stuff. And a nurse practitioner had prescribed it, and when they had a staffing, a liaison that we work with brought it up, and I know that they've cut him back onto something else, and he's still taking painkillers, but it's not Dilaudid, and I know that the nurse practitioner definitely got wrote up about it. So I'm definitely seeing the VA take a little bit more active role, but I also know that, you know, they mail out tons and tons of medication all the time. It's amazing. We lock up the meds in our house, and we've had to go from it's a 10 bed facility. We've had to go from having these old post office boxes that we had rekeyed to basically lateral files a lot, because some folks had way more meds than we could fit into the individual containers.
So. Wow. Well, I know in the programs as a sponsor, sometimes it comes up a sponsee's medication. And I'm big on this, that we're not doctors. But sometimes some
mm-hmm.
of the medication does seem excessive, as the person is not able to respond, you know, cognitive thinking or the lay of the land, just common, you know, what I've discovered,
right.
Common sense isn't as common as you might think. And so, but the, you know, it might be Xanax, it might be, you know, whatever. What I suggest, though, is that they get a second opinion.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a very
and if
good
you
idea.
Yeah, and that's all you can do, because, you know, I'm not a doctor and I'm not a therapist, and the 12 steps are not a therapy. I don't, you know, they're not our patients. We're not there with that therapist. Even if you are a therapist, you don't act in that capacity.
Right.
So I think
right.
the best thing we can do is just say, look, why don't you just see about, and I've done this before, get another medical opinion. And then if the second doctor agrees or disagrees, whatever, well, then that's as far as I can go as a sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, as a parent, it's all bets are off. I've experienced that. The things that we normally would do in program with a stranger, when it comes to family, there's an emotional connection, and somehow we go over and above what we would do in the program. So.
Right. Yeah,
so what we have to do on
our
radio broadcast is
for all of our listeners, we do recommend that you follow your doctor's orders, you stand your medications, and do that until the doctor changes things and says to do something different.
Yeah, because we're not doctors, so we could say we're lay people. So what are you going to do? You have one lay person telling another lay person about medicine? No, that's not going to – that's no. And we've had situations I know personally I had a sponsor who was manic depressive. And, of course, he was on medication. And he knows of people that the sponsor – was trying to wean, you know, like the 12 steps is like the magic solution to all medical problems. You know, they are for most, but not all. And they had people get off, tell them, you know, shame them, trying to listen to the sponsor to get off their medication, and hung themselves.
Oh, geez. Yeah,
yeah, it's been...
I mean, it's... Right, I mean, this is just an opinion that I think they do. They give them too much sometimes, so because sometimes folks are seeking it, and so instead of sitting down with them and finding out what's really going on, I think sometimes it's easier to write the script. But at least what I've seen.
Well, yeah, especially in the VA. I go to the VA. I'm a veteran, and I'll go to the VA. I have regular medical too because I want to make sure all my bases are covered. But I'm like that.
Good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. See, the problem with the VA is that they're overwhelmed. Overwhelmed and understaffed.
No, they do a great job. They do. I mean, we work very closely with the VA, and they, you know, they really care about the men and women that they're serving, and they are trying to do their best job. And they are doing some more kind of innovative things, at least at the VA near us, and you know, they're doing mindfulness and meditation and things like that to kind of help people find alternatives to pain medication. So, which I think is really positive.
Yeah, no, they're growing. I think they're getting more into the now, you know. But that's like anything; it's mm-hmm. a large organization and takes a lot of money. You know, it's a tremendous,
yeah.
you know, billions of dollars to run these things. You know, and the organization is just unbelievable to get that going. Give me your son's name again. What was his name again?
Michael Patrick Campbell.
Okay. Now, go ahead.
I was just going to say he was 31 when he passed away.
Ah, okay. So there was some time in between the medication. What was going on in between? Was there?
Well, as I've gone back and recreated what went on, I remembered some of the behaviors after he had broken his wrist. I can remember him being angry because he had called the doctor and they wouldn't give him any more prescriptions because of the injury to his wrist. And I remembered that. And then, you know, pills came up missing, and I actually thought it was a housekeeper that we had, but now I think it was Mike. But, you know, so there were pills missing and other things missing. Like, I had surgery one time, and I know there was a bottle of some liquid, but it was an opiate, and it was missing. And that wasn't the only time. So... Basically, he was very skilled at hiding it. He was high functioning. He continued to progress in his employment. He had gotten a promotion to customer service manager at the store that he worked at about 4 months before he died. And he was still doing well. And then he, kind of saw him start to slide. What I found since then is there was some man named Paul who was a cancer patient who didn't take the hydrocodone that he was prescribed, but he instead sold it. And Mike,
yes.
I know that Mike had bought some from him. And so I think, you know, that just made it more intense. And so, you know, and a lot of I think some of the times I didn't want to see it because what I feared was that my son would lose. His world. The mother's somewhat manipulative, and anyway, I won't get into all that detail, but so I was afraid, you know, I didn't get involved, and but I didn't want him to lose Jamin. And so you know, he was what was going on. And I know that there was one time that the only time there was any indication from a legal standpoint that he had an issue, he had taken the Xanax and he was driving and had gotten pulled over, but he was able to talk his way out. He had taken too much Xanax and was weaving around, but he was able to talk his way out of the ticket, and or, you know, or being arrested for DUI, which would have certainly gotten his attention. And so I was disappointed that he didn't get arrested then, because that would have, you know, gotten his attention, but also gotten him in a situation where he wouldn't have had access, at least until he got out. But that didn't happen. I remember having a discussion with him, and I said, you know what, you need to, you've got to be careful and not drive when you take anything, because if you hurt somebody else, you could never live with yourself. And, you know, he agreed. So that was probably about 6 months before he passed away. And the girlfriend and the mother of his child was trying to control everything, but she wasn't talking about it either. So she would take his money, and so there were times that the Monday, he died on a Wednesday night or a Thursday morning, and he was out of his prescription for Xanax. I knew that if he didn't have it, it was going to be really difficult for him, because if he started to go into withdrawal. So I gave him my credit card number, and he filled the prescription. I had no idea that he would take as many as he did, but I got a text from the girlfriend the following day that said that Mike had thrown up all over, and she was really mad because he hadn't cleaned it up, but he was passed out. So I went right over. First thing I did was count the pills to find out how many he had taken. He had taken 56 Xanax. And so
how many?
I confiscated 56.
Holy
so
cow.
His tolerance was high. But I confiscated them. I said, I bought them, and I'm taking them. He needs to contact me. And my intent was to, you know, get him into treatment. And so he did. He called me the next day. He actually came, and he finally said, Mom, I need help. And I said, Mike, first and foremost, I love you no matter what, and we will, you know, we're going to get you help. You need to go to treatment. And so, you know, I started calling around to see, and we found a place for him to go. And I said, but the thing is, Mike, I'm not going to keep your secret anymore. You need to come back with Sarah, and we need to develop a plan. And so he agreed to do that. In the meantime, I didn't know that he had gone to the dock in the box down the street from his work, because he had strep throat and was prescribed hydrocodone cough syrup. And so anyway, they came back, we developed a contract of what he was going to do, and, you know, he's supposed to call the treatment provider in the morning. And anyway, so we developed the plan, and he gave me a big hug and kissed me on the top of the head and told me he loved me. And they drove off, and I remember looking up in the sky and said, God, please watch over him. And the next morning he was dead. He and the autopsy showed that he had a therapeutic dose of Xanax, but he had a lethal dose of hydrocodone. He had drank the whole bottle. And so he stopped breathing. And that was, I have to say that losing a child is the most difficult thing I've ever been through. And I don't wish on anybody. And so what I envision, what I'm doing, or the work that there's a group of us that are working on it, is we are doing, I feel like I'm doing a project jointly with Mike. Mike's participation is through a story. And that was actually one of the things that was really interesting about that last day that I spent with him. He was always pretty quiet. He wouldn't have wanted to, you know, be flashy or anything, but he said to me, this was in the afternoon before the evening situation, he goes, Mom, you can tell my story. And so that has stuck in my head about, you know, I think there's a bigger mission here that he was a part of getting me started on. And so I feel this calling to do what I can to educate people about the dangers of prescription drugs. And so that's why I started Connect the Pieces. And the Connect the Pieces is about kind of when he first died and we got together with his friends. Friends were talking about, gosh, we were going to do an intervention with him, but we never did it, and it never got together and did it. And I was thinking, well, why didn't anybody ever tell me about how bad it was? These were people that were seeing him at work and things, and they never did. So that was kind of the beginning of Connect the Pieces, and that was the message at his funeral, was if you know somebody struggling, talk about it, you know, so that they can get help, you know, so that hopefully we can talk to them and then hopefully they'll make that choice to get help. And so that was kind of how it started. Then I realized that not only is that, you know, important on a small family level scale, but it's also important at a community level. So Connect the Pieces tries to connect law enforcement, state and local government, the medical community together to work on this issue, because if we all do something, it's going to be better. So that's kind of the whole thought around Connect the Pieces, and we've done a lot of education, but the newest part is our video game that's called The Amazing Adventures of Pharmacist Phil. And it's
Say that again. The Amazing Adventures of what?
Of Pharmacist Phil. And it's a game that people can go to. It's at connectthepieces.org. And you click on that. We have the game is in both English and Spanish. So people can go there now. It's free. What we hope to do is market it to medical professionals like pharmacists and doctors and dentists to use it as an educational tool to start the conversation about prescription drug safety, because I think that message needs to come from the doctors and the dentists and the nurses that can prescribe and pharmacists, because we trust them. And they need to be talking about how dangerous prescription drugs can be. Is my sense of it. So that's what we're trying to do, is to figure out a way to give medical professionals an easy way to start that conversation in a format that appeals to kids, and hopefully through appealing to kids, that will draw parents into it too, so that their behavior starts to change.
Something you had mentioned about the when Mike was pulled over with the police officer, of course, the police officer is looking for alcohol. He didn't smell any alcohol.
Right.
He could see something was erratic, but, you know, people are sleepy. He might have, you know, usually the jargon is, oh, you know, I really worked. I didn't sleep well last night, and I'm, you know, and I got a lot of things on my mind.
I'm sure
I'm
sure that was what he, you know, I'm sure that it was something like that. The thing that I was concerned about, he did have one of my oldest grandchild with him. And so I didn't want him to hurt somebody else either. You know, that's one of the way. I mean, getting involved with the legal system is often one of the ways that people start to realize they've got a problem. And I certainly didn't want him to go through that, but I wouldn't stop him from having any consequences. But he didn't, that didn't slow it down.
No. Well, after the fact, we all think that you know, like if he was in there and he called your mom, you know, I'm in jail, can you get me out? Chances are, as a parent, you don't want him in jail, so you're going to do what you can to get him out.
I know.
That's just what you would have done, I would have done, most people would have done. Very few parents are going to say, no, son, you screwed up, you're going to have to pay the price. You know, and when the parents do that, now they're taking an active role, but, you know, letting God take care of it. You got yourself in, you're going to have to figure this out, and hopefully that pain is a wake-up call. A lot of people forget that. I was in a meeting several years ago, and this fellow Christian, he's talking about going out drinking. I consider drugs and alcohol same old, drug old, same old, same old. A lot of people don't. It's an addiction. So, and it's especially drugs and alcohol, because alcohol is a drug. It was an illegal drug back in the 30s, if you remember the Volstead Act.
Yep.
So, the alcoholic particularly, you know, the elitist mentality, and then the drug addict just picked that up, and you don't belong here. It's the same thing. So I don't see any real difference in it. There's an empathy that goes along with step one because it mentions the addictive substance. So it's good to have at least some empathy, but I don't think I've ever run into very few alcoholics have never done drugs. You know, like, now I've met drug addicts that really weren't drinkers, but I've never really met a drinker that never did drugs. It just depends what was available. You know, we were an equal opportunity employer when it came to drugs and alcohol. Oh, okay, you got cocaine? Okay, well, what do you got? Oh, you got that? Okay, let's go. All righty, sign me up. So he's talking about his situation, and he's going to go out one more time and get high, get drunk. And this happens quite a bit in the program because now he's probably gone to some meetings, and he's thinking, I got to quit. So I'm going to go out one more time. A lot of people die in this one more time, the last hurrah, I call it. They're going out for one more really big high, and then they're never going to do it again. How insane is that? But that's the way the addict thinks. That's the mentality. So he's out there, and he's in the bar, and he's writing his experience down at the bar as he's getting drunk. So he doesn't want to miss anything of his last drunk. How romantic. Gets in his car, and he drives. He's driving. He's driving real drunk, and he drives. He makes it to the gate to his apartment house, and makes it through the gate, and then he's there and parked, and all of a sudden he starts praying, and he says, Lord, thank you for getting me here safely. And soon as the words just barely got out of his mouth, the red light from the police car started flashing.
Oh, no.
And he rolls down the window, and he says, yes, officer, because he smells like booze, you know, like there's nowhere to hide it. And he says, what's wrong, officer? He says, you know, you've been running on a flat tire for 3 miles. he went to jail, and he was in the meeting, and he was saying that he was in a lot of pain after the meet, you know. But after the meeting, I says, you know, Christian, I can handle all of your pain. And that was the last time, as far as I know, that was the last time he drank. It was
his last time, and God did answer his prayer. And I've known the other way. I've known some girls that have gone in, and one girl in particular, and she was just devastated from a nice family. You know, only those people went to jail, and she was in jail, and it crushed her. She was just going to get sober. She lasted about 2 weeks, and then she was gone again.
Yeah.
So fear sometimes we find doesn't really do that, but these experiences having these experiences sometimes are more than necessary. You know, we find the bottom. You got to find the bottom somewhere. And what often happens, and like I know, I've lost two daughters from the disease. My oldest daughter, my ex-wife, was an enabler. So she stayed in denial about the disease and would not address it because she's not an addictive person. Although she's addicted to Xanax, you know, her husband now says, yeah, we have the Xanax Zeppelin circles the house. You know, she's been on Xanax for about 20 years now, but she doesn't connect up the fact that she's an addict. Oh, yeah. She doesn't connect up the fact that she's very religious, too. Watch out. Be careful.
Very.
So now that you look back, what would have you done differently?
I think I would have what I would have done is definitely called him out on, you know, on behaviors that I saw, and not worry about him, you know, not worrying about like him losing his son and things like that, which, you know, he ultimately did. And I have too. The mother doesn't let me see my grandson that spent every weekend with me from his birth till he was 5 and a half. So I think maybe it was more me worrying about losing Jamin than, I don't know. Anyway, I think I would have been, you know, some of the things that I thought about doing that I didn't do is writing to his doctor and saying, you know what, he's got a problem. And I know that she couldn't have talked to me, but I could give her information.
That's true, yes.
And I let me know. I think that there was one time he was in the hospital, and I saw some behaviors that made me really nervous. It was about 5 months before he passed away, and I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to say to the doctor, said, "Don't you see all these behaviors?" I mean, he knew about hardcore stuff like the lot and then stuff like that, which made me go, wow, I think this is a lot more serious. But I didn't say anything. So I think the biggest thing is I would have started talking about it and talking to him about it and, you know, helping him find the resources. You know, every time I did try to talk to him, he would always minimize it. But I think that definitely a family intervention could have been helpful. I don't know. You know, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, my first sponsor used to say, Joseph, if I need some minimalization, rationalization, or justification, I'll call you.
Yeah.
We're really good at minimizing and justifying and rationalizing our addiction. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, and then me working in the field, I'm doing mostly administration, so I'm not doing that much directly with people with addictions, but I know about the manipulations, and I got, you know, but with my own son, it's different than when you're doing it with folks that aren't related to you. You know, I can call BS on, you know, behaviors and stuff, but with my own son, I definitely was in denial. He was
had
a good
sponsor.
Kid. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, a lot of them. Yeah, you lose some of the best. No doubt. It's some of the best,
I mean,
and then the heartbreak. You know,
well,
and
you know,
it's... Go ahead.
Yeah, my oldest son, was always the envelope. He's wonderful. He's got 11 years of recovery now, but he was an envelope pusher, and he was always testing every limit. When Mike would just kind of hang back and, you know, go, ooh, that got Steve in trouble. I'm not going to try that. And so in fact, my son has indicated he thinks that, you know, Mike didn't know how to cope with the trouble, and that was part of what went on because he never gotten any. But, you know, we don't know. But we miss him a lot.
I'm sure you will. Well, this is where, you know, a higher spiritual, if you believe in an afterlife, then you get the opportunity to see him again. I believe that. This is like
do.
I'm sitting
I
here.
Do too. Mike's death has definitely impacted my spirituality. Wasn't real involved in organized religion at all, and still am not greatly, but it has definitely made me a lot more aware of the afterlife and what can happen, and I totally believe that I will see him again. I believe that he's working on the other side to help with the stuff that I'm working on. So I know he's there, and I can feel his presence, and I can talk to him. I don't always hear an answer, but
yeah.
I get signs all the time. So, you know, I know he's there, and I know he cares.
Serendipity, synchronicity,
mm-hmm.
and coincidence
mm-hmm.
is only God incognito.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
As a parent, there's always, I look back to, if I only would have done something differently, like I would have had a really control over this thing. And, you know, after being in recovery for 17 years, I have to look at it, look, you know, I did what I did, what I thought was best at the time, and, you know, I'm really not in
mm-hmm.
control of the universe, you know, and that's...
You're not either?
No. Oh, you know, they just had a discovery that there's, scientific discovery that there's another and separate universe. I was elated when I heard that because I immediately applied for the position of center.
Have you heard that? On your application.
Yeah, really. I laid like the position of center of the universe. Had a sponsee one time and early on, and Mike, and kind of brilliant guy, bipolar, and like a lot of bipolar folks are real brilliant. You know, they have their, you know, the way their thinking processes are, and. He was really a hard drunk, and he would drink copious amounts of booze. It's like a liter at a time at a sitting, you know. And I'm trying to work with him. He had another sponsor, and then he said, "Well, you're not going to take my BS." And so I picked him up, and he got drunk like that one time. He couldn't even make it to a meeting because his withdrawal time was almost a week. And finally, we started working like my sponsor worked, and we're reading the big book and all that, and. He had him call me every day, and Sunday I'm in Houston. I live in Houston now, but I was living in Austin, and he called on a Sunday night. I didn't pick up the call. I talked to him every day, and I called him first thing that morning on the way back to Austin, and he told me that everything was okay. He was just checking in. He had read the big book. He shared in a meeting. He did his reading assignment. He got a contract to do some work. You know, he was real excited, and that was Monday morning at 7:30 in the morning. Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, his wife called me and said, "You lost another one."
Oh, dear.
So he had drank, and see, my daughter had just died a year before that. She didn't know that, but it was kind of like it hit me right between the eyes. You lost another one. You know, like my mind flipped out. And he said he drank so much that he went into anaphylactic shock and died. So the next time I see Mike, he's in a number 10 can canister with his Navy picture there, and that was the end of Mike.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I said, you know,
And of course, I blame myself. I didn't sponsor anybody for 2 years after that because I took blame that I didn't know enough about sponsorship. Later on, I found that Bill W. said that a good sponsor is a friend, a mentor, and a sounding board. A bad sponsor can mean the difference between life and death. And that's why we put together Rum Radio. So in closing, do you have anything else, Melanie, that you'd like to tell us about your work? Where to find it and all that one more time?
Oh, okay.
I've been to the website. I just went to the website. It's really a great website, wonderful work. Thank you for putting that all together. And I played the little video game on my iPhone also.
Oh, good.
That's kind of fun. What a great thing to do with all that energy.
Yeah, well, it's been good. And, you know, I know that certainly know that Mike has influenced it. He loved to play video games, and his son loved to play video games. And this is, I actually dedicate the video game to my grandson, Jamin, because I don't get to see him, so I'm hoping that he can play this game and still learn about prescription drug safety. But, you know, I welcome people to go on the site and play and have their kids play it, and some great stuff for them to learn. So we want to start teaching little ones before they get exposed to misuse of prescription drugs, which starts at about age 12. So we want to let, you know, we want them to understand what should be happening, that meds should be locked up in your house, and that you need to dispose of them properly, and all of those things.
Yes, that's very important.
I'd like to say this, and this might be a little comfort. It's in the scriptures. It says, I refine you not like silver, but I refine you in the furnace of affliction. For many are called, but few are chosen. So sometimes this is just God refining us to do a bigger work. So you've been picked. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
No, I definitely, you know, that's one of the things that I realize is the work I've done for the last 12 years working with addicts, that we were the village down the river pulling the babies out. And so with Mike's death, it made me realize I needed to go up the river and find out why the babies are coming down the river. And so that's what I'm doing. And trying to stop the babies from getting into the river in the first place.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
No, glad to. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome.
And
any
again,
last words, Harold?
Well, I just want to, again, mention the website. It's connectthepieces.org. connectthepieces.org, connectthepieces.org, and it's great to see fun, wonderful stuff happening there. That's great. And for you parents that have lost children, it's a very big job, important job to properly grieve that and be able to really complete your grief work. The American Medical Association has announced years ago that, in their opinion, 75% of physical illness is linked to beginning our grief work but being unable to finish it. So please get with a group, a support group, a grief support group, and do your grief work properly. Very important for your physical health. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, thank you. In closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. And that's a little over 4 years. But we're providing a service. We hope it is a no-charge service. It's a free. Take a look. Don't have contempt prior to investigation, and keep an open mind. You're going to find some really good stuff in there. And like usual, Remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.